Welcome to University Drive, your pathway to the transformational work of University of the Bahamas. Our goal is to build a better Bahamas by shaping tomorrow's leaders today, finding solutions to challenges, and forging new opportunities for growth. University Drive, where faculty, staff, students, and alumni travel the road of progress together with you.
In many ways, the story of the Bahamas, the events, change makers, and movements are still being uncovered, documented, and told. On the front lines of that effort are researchers dedicated to tracing the truth and capturing it not only for posterity, but to shine a light on the completeness of the Bahamian narrative. Hello, everyone. I'm Tamika Lundy. I'm your host for University Drive. Thank you so much for joining us. Joining us for this episode are our guests, Dr. Christopher Curry, who is the director of the Antiquities, Monuments, and Museums Corporation, and Dr. Keith Tinker, former director of the AMMC and adjunct faculty at University of the Bahamas. They are collaborating on the research project entitled March on Bahamaland, Nation Formation and the Emergence of the Modern Bahamas, 1920 to 2020. Thank you both for joining us. Dr. Curry, welcome back. I will soon make you my co-host, and Dr. Tinker, we're glad to have you as our guest for the first time. Welcome, gentlemen.
Good evening. It's great to be here.
And likewise, my pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Thank you for accepting my invitation. Your research project recently received a grant under the Wilson Awards Program, created through the generosity of Sir Franklin Wilson, Sharon Lady Wilson, and the Wilson Family Foundation, working with University of the Bahamas. From what I understand, the mission is to incentivize, to really spark the production of new knowledge that will directly impact our national development. What do you think of the Wilson Awards Program in terms of its mission, particularly as we are nearing the 50th anniversary of the independence of the Bahamas?
Well, I think it's a fantastic effort because what it does is it really provides the boost that academics and scholars and writers need to really get their work done. I recall when we were at the awards event that they held when it was made public and we had the big PR event, Dr. Tracy Thompson said this kind of puts some fire under her feet and causes her to have to really keep to their deadlines. When you have funding for projects, you really want to live up to the standard that is set, and you want to make sure that you complete the timelines that you have in place. So it's really good. It incentivizes research, and it comes at a really good time, you know, as you're about to celebrate the 50th next year.
I do concur. There are so many persons out there who are researching, who are coming across a very interesting tidbits of information that really we don't have it chronicled nowhere whatsoever. And here is an opportunity now for people to share that with the public. And there are many persons who would wish to do so, but just don't have the funds. So with that foundation, that is a huge boost for people to really get out there, get that information out and share it so that we could know who we are and from where we came from.
Certainly, and just so we provide a bit of context, do we as a Bahamian people, as a collective, do we know our Bahamian story? Do we know our history?
Well, I would say to answer that, most of us really don't, because, you know, for a long time, the history that was being told really wasn't our history. It was, you know, the colonial perspective. It was a history that was very top down. You know, you learn about the rulers rather than those people that were unfortunately ruled. It really took hold across the world in the 1960s and into the 70s. And again, it was really motivated in our region by decolonization and independence, the realization that we were our own masters, but we had a long legacy of colonialism that had really hampered the good history writing about the daily lives, the lived experiences of the majority of people in this country. So that has always been a challenge. And then because the system may have changed politically, the educational system didn't follow in step. And so again, a lot of our history that is taught in our schools isn't really a history that we can identify with or that resonates with us. So I would argue that, you know, the whole job of writing Bahamian history now is at a point where we really have to do a better job of telling our story, telling a different kind of story, and making it a story that we can relate to, one that kind of gives us a sense of collective memory, a storehouse of ideas and thoughts about the past. That's kind of what history is. And so it helps us with understanding who we are a little better. We still have a long way to go, though.
And I do say amen to do that. In the past, we've had a lot of our history, just like Dr. Curry indicated. Other people are really telling our stories. But what is so unfortunate is there were Bahamians in the past, I regret to say, that were also reiterating basically the same story. And you know, something that one of the previous prime ministers said, if the lions do not write their own story, it will always be the perspective of the hunters. And that's exactly what our fate had been for many, many years. So here now we have an opportunity where we could basically share. We can delve into our own history and share without bias, because I think that is very key right now.
Mm-hmm. And I would venture to say that before we can even tell our story, we have to uncover the truth, don't we? And your research project, the title of it is very honorable, right? It's called March on Bahamaland, Nation Formation and the Emergence of the Modern Bahamas. What really are you trying to uncover? What truth are you seeking to tell?
Well, instead of one truth, I say we have a number of truths that we're trying to tell. One of them is to dismantle this notion that nation formation occurred in a very short period of time, you know, from like 1967 or 1969, 70 to 72, and then into 73. That small window is important. It's truly a seminal period in our country's history. But what I would argue is the whole march to that moment, and the pun is intended, the march to that moment had a much longer process in place, going back to the 1920s and even earlier, to be honest, where you had proto-political organizations, people who were demanding change. They may not have been part of a formal political party. We know the first political party was formed in 53, but you had people marching up to Government House and making a list of grievances that they would give to the governor annually. You had people who petitioned on behalf of others to have rights accorded to them. You had a ballot party led by Milo Butler in the 1920s and 30s. You had the Citizens Committee formed 2 years before the PLP that were making demands on the Savoy being, prohibiting one of Sir Sidney Poitier's films from being shown, No Way Out. So, and then you were also making other demands. So you always had groups that were incubators of political ideas, even if they weren't formalized as an actual political party. So we want to explore that end. And then on the other end, we also want to move this whole process of nation formation through the period of the 60s, the 50s and the 60s, where you do have political parties and very staunch rivalries going on. And then you have the ideas of the progressive thinkers of the NCPIA. Again, they're part of a wing of the PLP, but they kind of cluster on ideas that are very progressive, and some might even say radical, that push the PLP in a particular direction and ultimately play a large role in the signature events of 67 and 65 and even 73. We also want to take our narrative to the other extent, or the other period, moving it forward to the 2020 moment, because one of the things we note in our country's history is we have a lot of work done on the quiet revolutionary period, but there's a huge dearth or gap of literature material really on what has happened to us since 1973 to the present. So we're trying to fill that historiographical gap while also looking at another gap, the earlier period that people don't seem to make much noise about or give much attention to. So I guess you could say, if you look at it from a continuum perspective, we have two gaps, one at the early period and then one at the contemporary period that need to be filled. And that's why looking at this 100-year period for me is important.
Why is nation formation in itself so important to look at?
Basically, we have to know who we are. One of the problems that has been for so many years is that the Bahamas has been identified as just another area of the Caribbean. If you will notice, if you will do a survey, you will notice that most people that are coming on the vacation to the Caribbean, they may be coming to the Bahamas, but they're going to say, I'm coming to the islands. What islands? Okay. They don't really basically say the island. And then sometimes they'll lump it all into and say, oh, we're going to Nassau. Mm-hmm. Well, what happens basically right now is the identification of the nation itself, we are trying to specify that. This is who we are. We are the Bahamas. And this is what made us and still make us the nation that we are. And so that's why we have gone to a wide variety of perspectives, not only just from persons who were very highly visibly active, but also some persons who are more silent. We even had interviews with some of the kids of some of the activists, because we never hear that in our books. We never hear that the families suffered. How did they fare when they were activating for basic justice and right? And so that's why we are trying to bring out as many perspectives as possible. They're not all the same. Even people that are from the same race and from the same political persuasion are not all the same. But you know, that's what people need to hear, and let them make up their mind what they think is right, what we tried to present as much as we can of that information so that people could get an understanding what we went through as a nation, as a country, to get to where we are to this point in time.
Just before we delve further into your methodology, your research is looking at the evolution of the Bahamas from a marginal British colony to a modern nation state. One of the things I find interesting is that you're positing that the ideas that shape political parties and this country were based on factors like the US civil rights movement and also some struggles that came about after World War II. Tell us about that.
Right. So, you know, one of my, I guess, criticisms of some of the scholarship that we've seen produced on the Quiet Revolution period, particularly, tends to appear as if what happens in the Bahamas occurred in a vacuum. But we know, and then, you know, Dr. Tinker is, I must admit, he is a fantastic scholar on diaspora movements, and he has a very strong foundation in Caribbean history. And so we both feel very strongly that, you know, to tell our story requires us to look from a pan-Caribbean and an African diasporic perspective. So we know that, for example, in the 1930s in the Caribbean, Franklin Knight, a great Jamaican historian, has argued this was the turbulent 30s, is the term he uses, because you had all these riots and boycotts and strikes going on in the Caribbean. Well, how did that translate to the Bahamas? Well, we had in Anagua, 37 riot, that might be a bit overstating, but it was a feud and it was a labor dispute. But even just a few years after that, in 1942, we did have a major riot, the Burma Road Riot. And that was influenced on based on ideas that were percolating around the Caribbean, that were coming into the Bahamas and influencing people. And let's not forget, you also had Garvey, Marcus Garvey, and his pan-African Black nationalist rhetoric that was very, very powerful and resonated with a lot of Bahamians that had gone abroad on contract or had worked in an earlier period in the Miami Craze area of South Florida. And so, you know, people come back home, or the ideas come from other ways through people traveling in this area via visa of the Panama Canal, or new immigrants migrating into the Bahamas from these areas where there's unrest and working as teachers or as police officers. People bring ideas into the country, and it affects the Bahamas. And so what we're trying to do is tell the larger story that the Bahamas is Quiet Revolution, the political changes from colony to country don't happen in a vacuum. They happen in a particular nestled area of changes happening in the United States, yes, with the civil rights movement, but also in the decolonized experiences of Caribbean people, and also in Africa as well. So all of that is something we want to handle in our work as well, to understand that while those places influence us, we also influence these places. Because I will tell you, Martin Luther King had a relationship with Randall Fox. And when he writes Randall Fox, he's not writing him in a place of, oh, you know, we are doing this, that, and the other. He's actually congratulating him for what he did in the role of a leader in a general strike. And he's congratulating him for that work. So we see how both movements kind of play off of each other.
So we're really talking about the waves of influence. Go ahead, Dr. Tinker.
Yes, no, I agree with that. But you continue. I don't want to add to it. I can't add to it, quite frankly, because that is succinct.
You've also asserted that there are gaps in the current historiography that exists. Now, what do we mean when we say that word? What do we mean when we talk about historiography? So we can fully understand.
I've taught an entire class on Caribbean methodology and historiography. And that word causes so many students to stumble, because they're like, well, what does that mean? You know, how do we define it? That's such a big, clumsy word. It's like the history of historians. So instead of telling a narrative, which is what most historians try to do. We always try to tell a good story and make a good argument. But what historiography is, it's studying the relationship and interactions between different works that have been produced by various historians, and how their works actually are like a conversation between each other, if you're following me. So I'll try to give a simple example. For years, Gail Saunders had this work out, Bahamian Loyalists and Their Slaves. And that was considered the standard book. You know, if you want to know about loyalists, you read that book.
Yeah.
Right? And I think it would have come out around 1983 when we were celebrating, or some people were celebrating, the biennial anniversary of the loyalists arriving in the Bahamas, 1783. Anyways, great book. But guess what? You know, her book, and I'm trying not to be too critical, but it did not really discuss Black loyalists, right? It didn't discuss persons of color who were also loyalists. It didn't discuss either, you know, some of the seedier sides of the history of white loyalists, and some of the troublesome issues that we sort of swept under the rug in presenting the loyalists as being great transformers, not realizing that they brought with them a whole race caste system that solidified a racial hierarchy that lasted for a long time in this country. So, you know, what I'm saying is my work and really kind of is a conversation that couldn't happen if Gail Saunders hadn't come out with her work. So my work challenges some of her ideas, right? As scholars do that in history, when we challenge each other's ideas or we contest another person's methodology, when we do that sort of thing, the kind of fight between the scholarship is what historiography really is.
And by your work, and by your work, you mean your work on the Black loyalists.
Right. But I only use that. I'm not trying to do self-promotion here. I'm just trying to find the easiest and simplest way of explaining what historiography is.
Indeed, we get it. So let's look at the gaps now. Let's look at the gaps that you want to, I'm assuming that you're addressing as you uncover what you're uncovering, right? What kind of gaps exist in relation to your own research that's ongoing now? I see you're referencing a lack of analytical framework for the uniqueness of the Bahamian political landscape.
Right, so what really that is about is the fact that we had a lot of, I would say, voluminous biographies and autobiographies by people rightly who were involved in the actual transformation from colony to country, whether it be Dame Marguerite Pinling, whether it be Clifford Darling, Clement Maynard. We just have so many, Randall Fox has done it. You have so many people who've written biographies. But my whole point there is biographies are good. They tell a story from a very personal place. But what biographies often lack is the sort of bigger picture. And oftentimes they do not have an analytical edge. They don't have a methodological anchor that makes the work more more magisterial in a way and a little bit more broad based, right? Because remember, a biography is you basically telling your story, right? But if you're telling a story from a multiple perspectives, which I think Dr. Tinker alluded to, and you're writing from a particular methodology, which we can talk about a little more, then the work, and I'm being careful, it doesn't make our work better. It just makes our work different enough to stand out as something that is significant.
Plus, there's a level of subjectivity, I would imagine, in the autobiographical position.
Yes, absolutely, right. And this again is why, speaking about methodology, we've picked persons who were engaged as actors in this whole fight, but we've also interviewed younger persons. We've made a point of interviewing people in the Family Islands. We've made a number of trips to other islands. And so, and again, you know, looking at gender as well. So we've already done about 20 plus interviews. And so we're trying to be very careful to move away from the biographical, and I would also say hagiographical, where you praise people beyond the point where it's necessary. And what we're trying to do is create a balanced perspective with an analytical perspective that drives the research and produces, I think, a balanced perspective.
So let's talk about that. How exactly are you doing your research?
As we indicated earlier, we have tried to identify persons who are in the struggle, but also people who are impacted by the struggle, i.e., for instance, some of the children of the strugglers, some of the spouses. What did they go through? what were their problems? What were their challenges? Because we don't have that chronicled practically anywhere, to be quite honest. And so let me just put a note on what Dr. Curry indicated. I would be bold enough to say that yes, we've gone one step further than would exist, primarily because now it widens the horizon for argument. Now you can argue even more wider because there are so much more evidence, so much more, many more perspectives that are coming forward. Because now you're hearing that Tom really didn't agree with Sam as well. And these are the things that are very necessary. We sometimes think that, oh, one group of people got together and they made a decision and they went forward and that was the action. Not necessarily so. And so what we're trying to do is to say, what was your perspective? And I bring that phrase back once more. Perspective is key. It's not necessarily relatively the truth, but it's the perspective.
This is a good place for us to take our first break. You're listening to University Drive. We will take a break, a short one, and be back after this.
My name is Nicolette Bethel, and I'm a 2022 Wilson Award grant recipient. It's called Spatial Justice in the Postcolonial Bahamas. That's a working title. I'm not sure what the final title is going to be. So this is something that has been interesting me for a long time. How we make sense out of, or don't make sense out of, the land we live in, the space we occupy, and how we continue to oppress ourselves through our organization of space and geography. Well, okay, so it's important for a couple of reasons. One, it's invisible. It's almost totally invisible and we don't realize when we're replicating it. Two, because we're an archipelago and we're the only archipelago of this size and magnitude in the Atlantic. Three, because our archipelago is really big and the Bahamas is actually the biggest country in the Caribbean, but we never think of it like that because we're always thinking about islands. But when you put all the islands together, spread across all the water, we're the biggest country in the Caribbean. We're big. Hopefully, what I have to say will uncover new ideas, possibly break new ground. Spatial justice isn't an entirely new thing, but there's only a couple of us working in this arena in this country right now. So I would hope that it shifts a conversation and puts UB at the center of that conversation.
For more on the Wilson Awards and the Wilson Grants to fuel Bahamian research, contact grants@ub.edu.bs.
Chapter One Bookstore is your back-to-school headquarters. We are proud to serve the students, faculty, and staff of the University of the Bahamas and the community at large. We are the premier choice for the purchase of university textbooks and supplies and UB logo apparel, paraphernalia, and gifts. We also carry a wide variety of school supplies, learning aids, and leisure books. Visit our copy center throughout the semester for all of your printing, copying, and binding needs. Chapter One Bookstore is located on the ground floor of the Michael Elson Complex. Shop with us on Monday through Friday between the hours of 8:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. Call us at 397-2650 or email us at chapter1@ub.edu.bs. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Chapter One Bookstore. See you soon!
Hi, I'm Sonia Farmer, and I'm a 2022 Wilson Award grant recipient. So my research project is called Indelible, and it's an oral history archive documenting experiences with and within citizenship with and within the Bahamas. And this project is composed of three parts. Overall, it's a digital humanities project, but there is an oral history archive, which contains testimonies engaging with experiences with citizenship in this country. The second part is a collaborative art project where the participants also complete an altered voter's card however they would like. And the third component is an educational framework, which provides toolkits so that we can engage with the crisis of citizenship in this country. So even though I'm coordinating this project and I've conceptualized this project, it's really primarily a collaborative project. I will be working with at least 50 different people speaking to me about their experiences with citizenship to make up this oral history archive. And I will also be working with historians, artists, human rights lawyers, and many other folks to create educational frameworks on the website as well so that we can engage with the history of citizenship and the current reality of citizenship. So it's really a collaborative project, and I'm really excited to be bringing everyone together to examine what it means to be Bahamian.
For more on the Wilson Awards and the Wilson Grants to fuel Bahamian research, contact grants@ub.edu.bs.
We're back here on University Drive. I'm your host, Tamika Lundy, and our guests are Dr. Keith Tinker and Dr. Christopher Curry. We're talking about their research project, March on Bahamaland, Nation Formation and the Emergence of the Modern Bahamas, 1920 to 2020. Gentlemen, we've been talking about the essence of your research, your methodology, and Dr. Tinker, the last thing you said is that perspective is key. You have said that you intend to talk to not only persons who were on the front lines of the period that you're researching, but even their children and other people around them. What is the value of this particular methodology?
The value, as Dr. Curry indicated earlier, is you have biographies that come forward. And in many instances, they are glossed. These are like heroes and heroines, untouched. And basically, we never get the perspective. How did the families fare when things were happening? How did the neighbors fare? How did people around you fare? Was there a particular religious activist who was able to lead his flock and became so influential of literally leading most of the protests? You very seldom hear that. And so this is why, excuse me, we wanted to bring as many people in as possible, and not necessarily people who are of the same race. We're talking about persons who are responsible, who are receptive to what we are speaking to, the subject, and who are able to share with us. And we, in turn, sharing with the nation and, by extension, the world.
You intend to go deeper, I am seeing, into what you're referring as the tumultuous period between 1968 and 1972 and dissenting politics. But you're also going to be looking at how it birthed the group known as the Dissident Eight, which I find to be a fascinating part of our political history. And you're saying that this kind of study is long overdue, given the significance of this group. Tell me more.
If I can quickly.
Go ahead, Dr. Tinker.
If I can very quickly. When those leaders, the eight, when they came forward and started to agitate, most people are not aware, but when we talk with the kids, we find out that those kids who had to go to schools suffered they had to go and be in a society where they were being ostracized. Why? There was never supposed to ever be Black people protesting against Black people. It sounds strange, but that's exactly what the perspective basically was.
Yes.
You were supposed to be a part of, not necessarily against. And this is why the dissident age really came forward, because they protest against certain things that their own party, which represented the race itself, the Black race, literally, that entered into politics, that came to the forefront in the 1950s and 1960s, and then took over the government with the promise that we will improve. And all of a sudden, that didn't really happen. So people begin to query, why are people not doing what they say they're doing? And this is why we wanted to bring all of this out. Because for some strange reason, most people, when they are writing, they are somewhat intimidated to really talk about it. They don't want to bring it out at all because they feel that, oh, they're going to be labeled. And we literally see that sometime in our interview, as though you are changing sides. You're in the side of this one, so forth and so on. No, we are trying to deal to tell a story that is altruistic as possible, and let people decide, at least they'll have an idea, what really happened in the past. Because this is really what shaped 1992. This is what shaped heretofore and after.
Got it. Dr. Curry?
Yeah, I think the dissidents are important because without them, we wouldn't have a two-party system that we have today. I mean, could you imagine if things continued? The UBP were derelict by 70. They were done. The infusion of thought and ideas from this dissident group merging, and there's debate as to whether it was a merger or not. But generally speaking, they needed the capital that the UBP presented, the Bay Street Boys, without the image of the UBPs at the front. And so it was, I guess you could call it a marriage of convenience. But without that marriage, we would not have the two-party system that we would have. And therefore, you could argue that democracy was saved in the Bahamas because of the fruitfulness that came out of the emerging Free National Movement. Now, the Free National Movement did have growing pains in the 70s, some serious factions within this new party nearly tore it apart, even as it was just growing up. But ultimately, they were able to resolve those things. And the penultimate moment for them, I believe, and still is, the 1992 election, when the FNM finally defeated the PLP. So ultimately, though, I think the legacy of the dissident eight and the reason why we need to study them is because they've birthed a two-party system now and have really assured us of a healthy democracy continuing. God forbid if things had happened differently, we might have been a single-party state. And I'm not saying that Pinling was a dictator. I'm not saying that. But certainly having a viable opposition was secured because of that marriage of convenience.
If I can add to that quickly also, this is why other parties have now emerged, because they're now emerging on the shoulders of the dissident eight, of the FNM. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because like Dr. Curry said, without those guys, there was just basically black and white.
Good
and
point.
That was it.
Good point. What I find interesting is that you're not only looking at party politics and the ideologies and also the leading figures, but you plan to also examine the economic policies and the budgetary issues, right? Within the context of those parties and what they were trying to do that would have an impact on national development. Why is that? Why is it important to look at the budgets, the budgetary issues?
Well, let me just say quickly, let's look at before 67, well, the 60s, going into the early 70s. If you examine how many public schools existed, how many high schools did we have? For the whole population, you know, how many? Did we have any on the family islands? In the documents, what I have seen, I'm sure Dr. Curry has basically seen the same. There was a policy for persons, particularly in the family islands, to be trained in the area of agrarian discipline. Stay on the farm. Go in the boat, stay on the farm. You aren't supposed to come up and think to be part of the quote unquote special 10%. I'm sure you understand what I'm basically saying there. 10% would have been,
Understood.
Yeah. Also,
go ahead.
No, you could take it further.
No, I was just going to say, you know, and this is building what you just said, Dr. Tinker, the UBP used to tout in their campaigning that they never had a deficit. You know, they didn't have a debt. The Treasury is always, in good hands. But, you know, that's a lie to the point that they didn't spend any money on the family island developments. They never did anything for educational development. They ignored social services and healthcare of the masses. So, you know, the reason why they could boast about, you know, balancing the budget and not having a major debt is because they never spent money. And so, you know, what we're saying in a nutshell is that part of the story of a political history of the Bahamas is about dollars and cents, how you justify and how you explain your budget every year, and where you spend your money says a lot about what you value, right? So if you don't spend any money on education, if you don't spend any money on healthcare, that tells me you don't value those things.
That's an interesting point. Let's just segue here into a different realm. We have historians and we have researchers who are adding to the body of new knowledge. How do we institutionalize the history, so to speak, and the information that's being produced so that Bahamians and the world, but especially our children and future generations, know it and can access it?
Well, I mean, the short answer is, you know, we have to work with the Ministry of Education so that, you know, the books that we write get used, and that the books that we write then also can be the springboard, the impetus to curriculum change. And I think those kind of things have to go hand in hand. You know, you have to have books that reflect relevant recent scholarship, cutting edge scholarship. But you also have to have a curriculum that reflects that as well, or is informed by the recent scholarship. So, because otherwise there's going to be a huge gap between what is being taught and what is being written, and that can't happen. So hopefully, you know, the way that we do this is by working with the educational system that we have to change it. I'm working currently on this project with the Ministry of Education, and I'm hoping that you know, maybe Dr. Tinker and I could consider after we do this book of maybe finding a way of doing an electronic Kindle version, you know, that may be a little bit more digestible, chapters that could be issued for the schools. And that might be a way of bridging the current gap that's there.
I was just about to ask, what are the outputs for the research that you're now doing and how do you plan to make it enduring? I was just about to ask about how is the public to consume the information that you're uncovering?
Yeah, well, we know our consumers, you know, they don't like reading 400-page books. So, you know, you have to find a way of using the social media platforms and digital age material to get the message out. Ebooks, I think, are the way to go. I know that the ministry has already commissioned a few persons to do ebooks. So we'll probably have to do the ebook route at some point.
Dr. Tinker?
I agree with that. I also would like to proffer that we get a start from the primary school. We need to be able from very young age, share some of this new information. How many persons between the three of us right now, let's just say the three of us, as we were kids, we did not hear about the Arawaks and the Caribs. And I'm sure that's what we heard. And we also heard that one ate the other one. That's not necessarily so. Now, I don't want to really delve into the details, but just to basically say that there are so many aspects of our history that we have never really properly shared and widely shared that is very necessary in order for us to understand what it is. I always tell people, when you're passing through Nassau, literally Nassau downtown, and you are going between, let's say, the Queen's Staircase and several other of those step areas that are going from Bay Street over the hill. And then you realize there is a socio-economic, political, and every other distinction between the two identities of where these the communities are, where their mindsets are, and how influenced they have been and been by whom. This is what shares our history. This is what shapes it. And that's what we're trying to really bring out. Say, listen, this is what happened over the hill, simultaneously what was happening in Nassau itself on the northern side. Because while you had a minority, that was not their story to be that of the history of the Bahamas.
Tracing the connections. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us. It's amazing, time flies when you're dealing with super good content. Thank you so much, Dr. Keith Tinker and Dr. Chris Curry for joining us on this episode. Any final thoughts?
I will just leave you with the words of Marcus Garvey, a man without knowledge of his past is like a tree without roots. So we need to continue to study if we want to know who we are.
And I'm also happy that I'm reiterating really that this opportunity is there. And thank you again to the Wilson family for this opportunity to share. That is so key.
Absolutely.
Let's hope that others will come forward and will equally or thereabout share allow other people to really say what their story really is, so that it's the lion that's sharing their story and not Buama, the hunter.
Thank you so much. We've been talking about our Bahamian history, and we've had two very expert researchers joining us for this very informative discussion, Dr. Keith Tinker and Dr. Christopher Curry. This has been University Drive. I'm your host, Tamika Lundy, signing off for now. Goodbye, everyone.
University Drive is a production of the Office of University Relations and the Communications and Creative Arts Academic Unit at University of the Bahamas. All rights reserved.